This Is Actually Happening is sponsored by Airbnb. I travel often, and when I'm away, my home never sits empty. I've been an Airbnb host for over 10 years, and it's always been the perfect way to make a little extra money to help supplement my travels while I'm gone. You can even plan around events, like maybe there's a big tournament coming to town and lots of fans will be visiting. You could Airbnb your home or extra room and make some extra money. Your home or spare room might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Today's episode is brought to you by Audible. Audible is the home of storytelling. In addition to an incredible selection of audiobooks, you'll discover thousands of podcasts from popular favorites to exclusive Audible originals from top celebrities, renowned experts, and exciting new voices in audio. Currently, I'm listening to Killers of the Flower Moon by David Gran after seeing the film and wanting to know more about the story. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/happening or text happening to 500-500. That's audible.com/happening or text happening to 500-500. Today's episode is brought to you by Audible. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic, 1984, on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Ilan Ishkeri that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've ever heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
Am I at fault? Am I to blame? Is this not a horror story? Am I not a victim? Should I not be able to say that because I let it happen? I don't know if in the human heart there will ever be black and white answers to something like that.
Welcome to the Permatemp Corporation. A presentation of the audio podcast, This Is Actually Happening. Episode 143. What if you were seduced into a whole new world?
This Is Actually Happening is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
I'm an only child, and my parents went from middle class to upper middle class. My dad was one of those executives who he would be gone for the entire week, and then he would fly home for Saturday and Sunday. He'd go golfing on Saturday, and on Sunday we'd all go to church, and then he'd be gone for another week. And that was pretty much my entire childhood. I got along a lot better with him growing up because I think he wasn't there. And so mom was the disciplinarian, and she was the one I always had fights with, and we were always arguing and always at each other's throats. And then dad would take me out when he got back, and he'd go, okay, you have to be the adult. You and your mom have to get along. I know she's crazy. She wasn't like that when I married her. Maybe when you came along. I don't know. Gee, thanks. It's all my fault. I mean, it was funny. We were bonding against how crazy she was, but then at the same time, he enabled that. And I don't want to say that they were bad parents, because they definitely weren't. They were doing the best they could, but they had their own hangups, and that showed in the way they raised me and in a lot of the, I guess, Christian propaganda. We were a very, I guess, stereotypical evangelical conservative Christian. Went to one of those churches called like First Christian Church or Central Christian Church. I went to church every week, apparently, from the week I was born to when I went to college, and a lot of time in between. So I was definitely one of those kids. And as far as my actual interests, I had two. I was a theater geek. I was a big drama kid. And also, I really loved reading and writing and English in general. So those were my two big things, which came out when I then went to college for English and theater arts, which are literally the most useless degrees that you can possibly come out of a double major with, especially in 2009 when the market crashes. So, yeah, it was really bad. I was 21 and a virgin. I didn't have my first kiss until I was 17. I didn't have my first boyfriend until I was 17, which was coincidentally my senior year in high school. I then had a boyfriend in my freshman year of college, and then nothing after that. Partially, I think that was because of growing up in the church, and they hammer home a lot of purity, chastity, like save it for marriage. You know, I wore a True Love Waits ring, if you know what that is. I read so many books, True Love Waits type books, and they would never discuss the fact that a girl might want to have sex or might have sexual desire at all. They never dreamed, probably in a million years, that a girl would masturbate. Guys can't control their penises, and women have to guard against ravening men, and it's our fault if we don't. Like, I had male Christian friends, and I'd come back to them after we got separated in these separate lectures, and I'd go, so what did they tell you about? And they were like, they told us not to jack off. That was definitely shaping, because a lot of my friends were hooking up in high school, and I for sure was not. And then I went to college, and I figured that as long as I stayed on the straight and narrow the way they wanted me to, I would continue to have a good relationship with them. Once I got off to college and started questioning, even remotely, some of the teachings of my church and of my childhood, that I thought, oh shit, I can't tell them about this at all because they would not understand and they would not want to know. The theater culture was very, the freshmen would drink off campus at these theater parties and people were hooking up, and I was always kind of on the outside of that. I was that annoying goody little two-shoes who wasn't breaking the rules, and so no one was really interested. That's the kind of person that I was. Very straight-laced and super guilty if I ever stepped out of line. I had a lot of guilt. Also, I had undiagnosed clinical depression from when I was probably in the eighth grade, but my parents also were the kind of Christians who didn't really believe in mental disorders, or they thought that you could pray them away, or when I tried to tell them that I was having thoughts of suicide randomly in the winter for no apparent reason, and I didn't understand why I couldn't feel anything all the time and everything was just flat, the response was like, how do you think your mother feels? Don't you care? Like, don't put this on her, and we're never talking about this again. So it took me until I was in college, and finally I was staring at my computer screen trying to write a report, and I literally physically could not do it. I just had this paralytic depression, and I realized, fuck, something is wrong. I should go talk to a school counselor. And then they put me on meds for the first time in my life, and suddenly a lot of things kind of made sense. So that was probably also part of my high school experience. I felt very distant from people because I literally, like, couldn't feel things on a deep level. The church that we had on campus was not just a church. It was also one of those, we'll let Hindu people hold meetings and we'll let the Jews do their stuff here. So it was very multicultural in that way. And I started attending some of the ceremonies for the other religions because I was just curious. I didn't know a ton. There was especially one, it was like a sand mandala thing with these monks who were in the library for a week, and they were just pouring sand in these really intricate patterns, and they made this beautiful giant thing, and then at the end, they just wreck it. They sweep it all up into bags, and they pour it in a river to symbolize how life is beautiful but transient. I remember watching that particularly and thinking, wow, I feel really close to God. I feel like that's holy and divine, but wait a minute. My church teachings say that they're going to hell because they're not following Jesus, and he is the way and the truth and the life. And I went, that feels extremely wrong to me, that something as pure and as cool as this is sending them to hell because they didn't say the right words. That kind of started the unraveling, I guess, of my faith, when I realized that other people had legitimate and valid paths to spirituality. I felt very guilty and I felt very bad because I didn't know, what had I done wrong? I must have done something wrong, or I would still have my faith. So I'm about to graduate with a totally worthless double major into one of the worst economies the world has ever seen, and I have absolutely no idea what I'm going to do with my life or with my job. In comes one of my professors in the English department, and he says, well, why don't you teach EFL, which is English as a foreign language? And he said, go teach EFL in Asia for a year or two, and you'll rack up some money. Maybe the economy will be better by the time you come back. And it's a cool thing you can do with an English degree that a lot of people don't do. And then they regret not traveling when they're young. The suggestion was good on its face. It had merit. So I applied to a couple of programs. And I got into one that offered me a job teaching in a hagwon, which is like an after-school private program in Seoul, in Korea. I graduated, and about a month later, I was on a plane headed to Seoul, teaching English to rich people's kids. Right before I got on the plane, I remember having this gut feeling that something was terribly wrong. And I called my mother and I said, I don't think I want to go. I think I want to back out. She was like, no, it's just nerves. You've already traveled the world once solo. You know how to do this. You're just worried because it's a whole year, and that's a really long time. And I was like, yeah, you're right. You're right. It'll be fine. So I get there, and the thing that I quickly discover about hagwons is my school reported maybe 4 or 5 English teachers on the payroll, and there were way more than that of us. But if they underreported, then they wouldn't have to pay a bunch on government benefits under our visas. So we wouldn't get the healthcare that we'd been promised and stuff like that. And when a bunch of us confronted them about it, we were told, you can have 2 of 3 things, pick 2. You can either have your government benefits and your salary, like your entire paycheck, or the other, like the third thing is, you can have a nice place to live. So either we'll downgrade where you live, we'll cut your check, or you won't get your government benefits. And since most of you aren't getting them anyway, we know what we would suggest. My other co-teachers were way more interested in dating the locals than they were in hanging out, and I hadn't exactly gone to Korea with friends. So everyone that I knew and loved was like 10 to 12 hours opposite time from me, and I worked from 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. Those were our hagwon hours because they were an after-school kind of deal. so I didn't have much of a support network. Additionally, I was off my meds. So I was a clinical depressive not taking medication because no doctor in the world was going to prescribe me a year's worth of antidepressants and let me take them overseas. The second was that they were hoping at that time that I would be able to wean myself off the antidepressants and never have to go back on them again. So I was using this experience as a trial to see if I was still depressed or if I had gotten better. I went on a few disastrous dates with both soldiers in Taiwan and also some Korean men who mostly seemed to view me as a trophy, like checkbox, hey, I've now dated a white chick. So none of that really went anywhere. Something that I had known about myself for a long time was that I was interested in bondage. I was interested in being tied up. I didn't necessarily want to have sex, but I was definitely interested in being tied up. I feel like the first time that it kind of hit me was the movie Labyrinth. David Bowie has this riding crop and he's got, you know, the sexy voice and this very assertive personality, and he has this speech at the end that hit me somewhere, and I went, oh my God, that's the kind of relationship I want. And it's, fear me, love me, do as I say, and I will be your slave. Just let me rule you, and you can have everything you've ever wanted. I went, woof, that's it. Like, that's what I want. That's so attractive to me. I didn't know then that that was a power exchange relationship, but like, that's, yeah. I think that the first kind of interest that I had in kink in that way was it circumvented my Christian guilt entirely because they're up there on the top and I'm down here on the bottom and, oh no, I'm helpless. What will I do? You don't have to say no because, oh no, you're stuck. You're tied up. There's nothing you can do. But obviously they'd never actually do anything to you that you didn't want. But there's this plausible deniability there. I've talked to a lot of people in the kink community who were like, oh my God, me too. Yeah, I wanted to be tied up so that I could fuck and not feel bad about it. So this is when I decided I was going to put myself up on a site called Collar Me. I am still a virgin and I still want to remain a virgin. But Collar Me was like MySpace / Facebook / OkCupid for kinky people at that time. And it was one of those sites where you could see who'd looked at your profile because they hadn't thought of charging for that then. So one night I was on the site and I was looking to see who had looked at my profile, and there was this guy with this really interesting name. It was something Latin, and I don't remember now if it was Solivagus or Omniferum, but it was something like that. Very intellectual and not like Big Dick 69, which was a lot of what you were getting. So I read his profile and it was so interesting that I messaged him first and I said I had some questions, and he wrote me back and he said, personal or professional? And I said, kind of a little of both. So we started talking and eventually we started Skyping. This guy, Simon, was independently wealthy. He worked as a currency trader, but he had four women currently in his life. So it was a polyamorous type situation. They all knew about each other. They all lived under one roof. And he was looking for a fifth to complete his, I guess, inner circle. And he said, if you end up wanting to be with me, then you don't have to work. You don't have to worry about anything. You just have to pursue your passions and come be with me. He said, now, they work as independent escorts in Australia because it's legal there. But you, of course, don't have to. Like I said, you can do anything you want. He started pushing my boundaries on Skype, but I figured I was so young and naive and, again, virgin, that these were not unreasonable things to ask. So I just kind of went with it. He decided eventually that he wanted to come to Korea for a week and meet me. And then we'd decide if I wanted to go live with him or not. I felt both terrified and thrilled, I guess. It was that mix of like, you're going up the roller coaster and oh my God, you're gonna fall. But I was like, wow, now here is someone who lives a completely different life than I ever could have even imagined. Like, I didn't even know that you could have four different women who all knew about you, who are all okay with it, living with you. I didn't know that half of this stuff was a thing, but it fascinated me. So he lives in Brisbane, Australia with them, and his girls have come to him from all around the world. There was someone, I think, who is Australian. There was someone that he met while she was teaching in Thailand. There's someone, I think, who is British. So this isn't even a super uncommon thing for him to do, is to go to another country and make a trip to meet someone and maybe bring them back, apparently. Like, I would not have been the first. I am stuck in this country. I have no friends, and I am beginning to not hate South Korea. Like, South Korea itself is really cool, but it's very xenophobic and insular in a lot of ways. And I'm beginning to feel that. And here's a guy who's like, I'm going to take you away from all of that. So it looked like my lifeline. I'm, I guess, kind of weird in that if someone's brain, like their intelligence, is attractive to me, I'll probably find them hot because their personality and their intelligence is hot to me. So that makes the outer package hot to me. He was really tall, which appeals to me because I'm tall. I'm almost 6 feet. He was 6'5". He kind of looked, I guess, from the neck up, like kind of a nerd with the glasses and short brown hair and a little chubby. But I thought, well, if I want a man who's going to dominate me, quote unquote, then that definitely fits the bill. I was telling a couple of people that someone was going to come meet me, and they were like, oh God, this sounds full of red flags. You shouldn't go. You shouldn't meet him. But of course, I wasn't going to listen to that. So I totally went. I was sitting on this bench, and I'd been looking around waiting for him to come off the plane for a while. And then all of a sudden, I feel this tap on my shoulder. So I turn around and I look up and up and up and up. And oh my God, there he is. He's totally snuck past me, even though he's giant. So I stand up to hug him. And instead of a hug, he just kisses me immediately. This very passionate kiss that is totally inappropriate for Korea because they are not big on PDA. But after a second or two of being surprised, I went with it. So he rented a hotel room in Seoul, and there was always this expectation. It was never specifically discussed, but it didn't have to be. It was just this expectation that, like, I was going to have sex for the first time with him when he came. I can't really explain why, or because it doesn't sound like that makes sense. But he had this very, I guess, commanding presence about him and this self-assurance that made you go, yeah, okay, that makes sense. We'll go with that. So pretty much as soon as we got back to his hotel room, like, I hopped on top of him. I lowered myself down onto him. It hurt. Popped my hymen. And then I hopped right back off because I was like, oh, I don't want to have sex yet. And I have to go teach. We'll try this again later. I got dressed and I went to work. I don't think he was expecting that. The next day, he was like, I'm going to have anal sex with you. And if you want it to be comfortable, then I'm going to give you half an hour and you're going to go find lube. You're going to go find lubricant and bring it back here. And if you don't, then I'm going to leave the country without you. I don't even know why that was the threat, but that's what he said. Now, I am just barely not a virgin anymore, almost by a technicality, and I don't speak the language, and I feel ridiculously embarrassed and humiliated to try and ask these poor Korean women behind the counter, where's your lubricant? I was like, well, you're the one who would feel comfortable with this. Could you not do it? But no, it had to be me. Had to be me. It was this weird mix of love bombing, I think is what you would call it, and sometimes being really cold and ignoring me. Like, he had me quit my job without notice. I did something that's called a midnight runner, which is basically where Hagwon teachers get so fed up with the situation that they just leave the country. And they don't tell anybody. But they don't tell anybody because sometimes the Korean police will try and chase them down as they're leaving the country and get them to honor their contract. So, yeah, I did a midnight runner. I'm still in Korea, but I'm talking with his girls on the phone, and I'm with him, like, every moment that I'm not working, which at this point now I've quit my job, so I'm with him 24/7. And also, he's had me call my parents because, okay, so my parents were probably emotionally negligent or emotionally abusive in some fashion. So he had me call them because he was like, you need to distance yourself from your parents. You need to go no contact with them for a while. They're not healthy for you. They're not good for you. And they're hurting you. So he also pretty quickly had me distancing myself from any support network that I would have had. He tore down my beliefs in a way that was like, he'd say, I'm better than God. What has God ever done for you? What have God actually done for you? I'm doing things for you. I'm doing them right now. You can physically see the things that I'm doing. So if you had to choose between me and God, like, who would you pick? At each of these points, I'm thinking, you know, I've had other friends over the years who've said, hey, your parents aren't great. Or, like, I've had some people try to say these kinds of things to me before, but no one's ever said it like this. No one's ever been so in my face about it and just laid it out there, I guess. So he's just saying what other people have already said, right? But he's saying it in a big dramatic way. But I'm thinking, well, guess there might be something to this, whether I want to admit it or not, because, yeah, sometimes they have hurt me and sometimes they have done things that have been kind of toxic and bad. So maybe he's right. So I'm cycling through these things from my childhood that are kind of weird that other people's parents maybe don't do. And I'm going, yeah, maybe I do need a break from them. Maybe that would be wise. And I'm going, well, you're right. I guess I can't really objectively say that God has done anything for me, as bad as that sounds. Like, you actively are offering to take me away from a situation that I hate and take care of me. So on its face, you are better than something that may or may not exist. Sure, that's probably true. Within a few days already, my worldview is changing again, and he's now basically at its center.
This Is Actually Happening is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Drained or half full or bursting with energy? Why is this? Are you overscheduling yourself or not putting up enough boundaries? It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. But how do you find the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. For me, therapy has been a godsend in learning how to manage myself as an extrovert who always wants to be engaged with people, but also finding alone time for myself to ground and find my center again. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/happening today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, help.com/happening.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
When we leave South Korea within the week, instead of going to Australia, we end up going to Singapore. I guess there was this vacation that he had planned with all of his girls, and now I'm one of his girls, so I get to come too. It is this very lavish, very extravagant, like, tossing money around and staying at the best hotels and eating really well and buying a bunch of electronics and going to the zoo and just having a really good time. It did feel like a fantasy life.
When I got there, I mean, the actual activities were super fun. And I was like, oh my God, I'm traveling the world and I'm getting all this cool stuff and I'm getting new experience. Like, this is really neat. This is awesome. This is great. But the other girls weren't really friendly and he was often distracted. And there would be these meetings that they'd have that I wasn't a part of, I guess, talking about me, where they'd send me out and then I'd come back in. And at the same time, the girl who he'd brought on before me, Athena was her name, she wasn't happy. Of all the girls, she was the least happy that there was a fifth coming because she felt like she didn't have enough time with him or whatever. And he had to spend a lot of time behind closed doors with her, comforting her. When what he'd said was, well, you're new. And so when I bring you on board, I'm going to spend all my time with you. You get to sleep in the bed with me. You get to have the attention. You're new. That didn't necessarily always happen. And part of that not always happening was I would have to go beg one of the other girls, can I sleep with you tonight? And the price for being able to sleep with them was sometimes very literally, biblically sleeping with them. Like, I didn't have a place to stay, so I would have to perform sex acts for them in hopes that they would let me share their bed. I was bi-curious at most, is how I had described myself, but this was not fun. This felt like a chore. This felt like something that I had to do so that I could get the thing that I actually wanted. And they, of course, could tell that. And he and they both criticized my sexual performance pretty much from the get-go. You're not being enthusiastic in the right way. And they said, here, watch some porn. That'll help. But it wasn't just watch some porn. We're talking the weirdest and the most out there and the most extreme porn that you can find. That's what I'm watching to try and learn how to be sexual and have sex. The hentai manga that has bestiality and it has underage stuff and like the porn with, you know, scat fetishes and like nuns and priests and it's German and there's whipping and like it's so out there. So that when he comes back with a request like perform ass to mouth, I would feel that that is not actually very extreme compared to some of the things that I have now watched. The first two girls who come on board, Erica and Roka, they were best friends. They were at each other's backs all the time and they never seemed to fight with each other. Athena seemed like she was pretty much on her own the same way I was on my own. And I thought, well, maybe we can be friends because she's new too, but I was a threat because I was newer than her. And then there was one other girl who sort of was and sort of wasn't. Like, she was included in the core five, but she didn't really sleep with him. And that was Lindsay. And she was more of a friend and business partner. But, like, she lived in the house, and she also escorted. And she, I think, had a sexual relationship with him in the past, but they didn't anymore. So she would often go off and do her own thing. Of all of them, Lindsay was definitely the nicest to me. And he pitted us not just against each other in attention, like vying for attention to him, but he kind of pitted us against ourselves. Like he tried to convince us that we all had these terrible things wrong with us and that he was the only one who would ever accept us and love us. But I'm pretty sure there were things that he tried to plant in us. Like he told one of them that she was a pedophile. And he told one of them that she was interested in snuff. She wanted to watch someone die and she'd get off on it sexually. He tried to tell me that I was sexually attracted to my father. At a certain point, I didn't learn this at the beginning, but I did learn it eventually. You just go along with it whether you believe it or not, because it's easier that way. You only fight for the things that you really, really, really care about and have a stake in. And that just wasn't one of them. It sounds awful because, of course, I'm not sexually attracted to my father, but I had so many other things going on. I was like, sure, Simon, sure, whatever you say. I know that this is off the rails as far as anything that I have ever experienced before, but I also know that I am super naive and ignorant because I spent my whole life in the church, sheltered, growing up. And so I don't want to shame other people for how they live. So I'm thinking, well, if these people are happy and this is a valid lifestyle choice, like, who am I to say this is fucked up? I mean, I think some of the things that he's saying sometimes are a little fucked up, but are you throwing the baby out with the bathwater? Everything good that he's doing and everything good that he's saying and the good in the relationship, does that have to go just because he's kind of weird? Because he'd been right about so much else, you know? He'd been right about my parents and, you know, he'd been right about religion. So it's like, okay, a lot of his ideas are weird and out there, but he is right about a lot of this stuff. Because he was good at psychology. He was really good at telling what your weak points were and pressing on them. It was like I was having the world's most fucked up form of therapy is kind of how it felt. So in the middle of the Singapore week, two of his girls, I think it was Erica and Roka, they were taking a trip to Thailand. And he said, why don't you go with them? And I went, sure, I'd love to. Thanks. So we roll up to Thailand and it pretty instantly becomes clear that they are making me over because they think I'm going to become an escort. And I tell them, no, that's actually not what's happening. He even did the all clear on that. Like, I don't have to do this and I'm not doing this and I'm not real sure why you're steamrolling me on this one. It's a little weird, but they kept going with it. I called him from a cafe in Thailand and I tried to bring that up. And somehow, though I don't remember how, the conversation got around to, would you let me kill you for insurance money? And I said, what the fuck? No. Of course I wouldn't. First of all, I don't even have life insurance. I'm worth more to you alive than dead. And second of all, that's a fucked up thing to ask someone. Like, God, no, of course I wouldn't. Why would you even say that? And he's like, it's not about whether or not it's realistic or feasible. It's about whether or not you would. It's not about whether it would actually happen. It's about whether or not you're willing. Because my life is worth more than yours. And so all the other girls are willing. They're okay with it. We argued for an hour in that fucking cafe over this whole thing. And I eventually realized at some point during the conversation that if I didn't say yes, he was going to hang up the phone. The other two girls were going to go back to Singapore and I was going to be stranded in Thailand alone and stuck. So eventually I just gave up. I said yes, we hung up the phone and that was that. And so I managed to get back to Singapore. The Singapore trip was mostly over after that. We went home to in Brisbane in Australia. And pretty much immediately after we got off the plane, he was looking on those adult hookup websites for someone for me to fuck, to have sex with, not for money, just in general, just a stranger for me to have sex with. And I was like, I literally started having sex with you like a week ago. Why am I suddenly now needing to have sex with someone else? He goes, because once you have sex with someone who's not me, who you don't care about, and you do it for free, you'll probably realize that you'd rather be getting paid. And I'm like, that really wasn't my goal. But then he starts asking these questions. Well, what are you going to do for a job? Well, that doesn't make very much money. Well, what about this? Well, no, that doesn't make too much money either. Look, my girls are bringing in like $250 an hour, $200 an hour. What can you do that makes that much money? And I'm like, I thought the goal wasn't for me to make you a bunch of money. I thought it was for me to pursue my dreams and my passions. And he springs this question on me that it will haunt me until the day I die. He said, of what worth or value are you to me? And I tried to list all of the things that I thought were good about myself. All of my good personality traits and all of my talents and all of my skills. And that didn't matter. What mattered was that I was not going to be bringing in money. And the only way that I could bring in enough money was to become an escort. And it killed me. Like, it killed my spirit, I think, to hear that from someone that I thought, well, if we don't love each other, we're definitely on the way there. And you said all these things, and you told me all of these things, and you said that I wouldn't have to, and you lied. I'm not saying that he drugged me and he forcibly held me down and he had men come in and rape me. That's not the kind of pressure that was being put on me. The kind of pressure was everyone is going to resent you and hate you because you're going to be a mouth to feed and you're not pulling your weight. He played currency trading. He played at that. But, I mean, he lost as much as he made. But there were giant stacks of cash laid out all around the house. Now I know where they were from. They were from the girls. Not from him. So, it's been literally less than a month. It's been like 2 weeks since I started having sex. And already they are putting me up on websites to have me be an independent escort charging $300 Aussie an hour for the privilege of my company. And I'm going to this nurse because this is one of the things that you have to do before you escort. You go and you talk to them and they do your blood work. Like, you have to have blood work. It's all very bureaucratic. And one of the questions that they ask is, are you doing this of your own free will? No one's pushing you into it. I had one of the girls out in the waiting room waiting for me. So, like, I was never alone. I was always with him or with at least one of his girls. There was never any time ever since I met him that I was ever allowed to be alone. Ever. But she was out there waiting in the waiting room, and the nurse asks me, are you doing this of your own free will? Have you been coerced anyway? And I've been coached on what to say. They told me, don't you dare mention Simon, and don't you dare mention the rest of us, because we all share this one hotel room that we work out of, and technically you're not supposed to do that. Technically you're supposed to have a hotel room for each individual person. No one cares, but, like, don't mention it, and don't mention us. Say that you're just doing it just for fun. If I say no, I don't really want to do this, then they're going to try and walk me out of the room and get me help, but they're going to walk me past his girls, and they're going to know. What am I supposed to say? Maybe that was my out, but I didn't feel like I could take it. As you can probably expect, I hated it, and I hated myself, and I hated the men who came to me, mostly. There are a few stories of men who I was like, why are you here? You can very obviously get sex for free, and you're a nice guy, and I don't want to see you here. Or, God, no, I don't want your first time to be with me, a prostitute. I want your first time to be with someone who cares about you and loves you. Or, like, a guy whose wife had died, and he was just really lonely, and he brought, like, a picnic, and we talked for an hour, and then we fucked. But, I mean, most of them, honestly, they treated choosing an escort like you'd choose something off the breakfast menu at McDonald's. What do I feel like today? It made me really resent so many men because I would always wonder when I was out, are they looking at me and thinking I can buy her? Are they thinking for a couple $100 an hour, I can own her? I'm a thing. So I didn't enjoy it, and I wasn't doing as well as they thought I should be. So they sent me to what they called boot camp, which was just, it was the brothels. There are brothels in Australia, legal brothels, and that is so much worse. That is infinitely worse than working as a quote-unquote independent escort. The clients are worse, and the conditions are worse, and I was stuck there for an entire weekend from, like, Friday to Monday, and sleep in these beds that they had upstairs over the sex rooms for people who were pulling multiple shifts, like I was. And I basically had nothing to eat, except I think there was bread and peanut butter in their lounge room, because I was saving all my money. There were men who literally looked like Santa Claus and said that they picked me because I reminded them of their granddaughters. Like, that is vile. There was one experience that I had there that I even then considered, I guess, rape. But as soon as you become a whore, you're no longer human. And whatever happens to you, it's your fault. And if you get raped, it's not rape, it's theft of services. Ha ha ha, get it? Like, I hate how the public views sex workers. It's so disgusting and dehumanizing. But there was an experience that I had there that even then I thought, maybe this is rape because I didn't want to be here and I didn't want to be having sex with you. And I was actively leaving the room to try and get you someone else because you weren't happy with me. And you grabbed me by the arm and you threw me on the bed and you were like, no, we'll do this. We're doing this. And then the condom broke. And I don't know if that was on purpose or not, so that he could get his money back. I mean, he did get his money back, if you were wondering. That is a policy. And then I had to be afraid that I had some stranger's possible
disease or possible baby up in me. And had to keep working. I just had to keep going. When I left that weekend and I got a cab back because they weren't going to come pick me up, the cab driver was like, oh, yeah, you work there? You work there? Yeah, I come see you. I'll come see you. I told him to drop me off a couple blocks before the actual house because I didn't want him to know where I lived.
I was in Australia for about 3 months doing this. And that's not even talking, of course, about all of the shit that he personally put us through. But things were kind of falling apart on that end. Rocha and Erica, I guess, weren't happy. They were thinking about going. He was having an argument with Erica once while I was performing oral sex on him. And he goes, oh, you wouldn't even know if you were being abused. Hey, you, look at me. Look up. So I look up. And he slaps me across the face. And he says, do you feel abused? And I shook my head because I wasn't even really sure what had just happened. But based on all the porn I'd been watching, I knew there was a lot of face slapping going on during sex. And so I figured, well, I guess that's pretty common then, huh? So I shook my head and I went back to it. And he was like, see, she doesn't feel like she's being abused. You wouldn't even know what abuse is. You're not being abused. He's saying this to Erica, to his girl that he's been with the longest, because she was complaining about how she'd been treated. There's the time that he held my fingers, and when I tried to pull back, he almost broke them. He did not break them, but he said that it would have been my fault if he did, and wouldn't I feel stupid trying to explain to the hospital what had happened? He would come into whatever room I was in at night if I wasn't sleeping with him. Like, he'd come in the middle of the night and, like, scream boo right by my ear because he wanted to scare the shit out of me just because he thought that was funny. And then at some point, Athena finally had it. She tried to leave. He flipped out. He went into a jealous spiral, and he chased after her to the detriment of all of us. He didn't really seem to care about any of us, just her, because she was trying to leave. After they got back together, we had to clean up the results of his drunken rampage. But she didn't live in the house anymore after that. So things were kind of falling apart with his little cult, the cult of Simon. And there were other satellite girls who were, if not part of the cult of Simon, they knew him and they'd had sex with him and they were quote unquote friends of his, but they just weren't like in the core living in the house. He was always on the lookout for other girls.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When I say that it was a cult, he used the BDSM jargon or the BDSM lingo, but he was under no circumstances dominant. He was just controlling. He controlled what we ate. He controlled what we wore. He controlled the money. Like, he was just controlling. But one of the things that he controlled kind of became his downfall where I was concerned, because he put us on this exercise regimen that I am convinced to this day was not about any of them getting thinner or us getting healthy. It was meant to exhaust us so that we could not think. If we didn't get up on time to go exercise, he always said he would punish us. One morning,
I got up on time and I got dressed and I went out to the hallway and I looked around and I didn't see anyone. And there were a lot of times that I just wasn't kept in the loop of whatever. And I figured this was one of those times, and that exercise was canceled for the morning, so I went back in the room and I sat down and I waited. Well, it turned out exercise had not been canceled, and because none of us got up, we were all punished. My punishment was to go live in the room that we all used at a hotel to escort from for a weekend and have no contact with him or with any of the girls. And if I wanted money for food or anything like that, I would need to earn it. That was kind of his mistake, because for the first time since I'd met him, I finally had space to breathe, and I had space to think, and I could contact people. I was talking to one of the satellite girls, who was a pregnant escort, who had a boyfriend, and she helped me through that weekend a lot. She went out to dinner with me, and, like, we'd talk and we'd hang out. She kind of trashed Simon a little. She was like, yeah, I would never want to be in your position. I would never want to live with him like you. Are you kidding me? He's just awful. Like, I would hate that. I don't know how you put up with half the stuff he does. Her boyfriend started chiming in and talking about it. And obviously, I wasn't considering any of this to be abusive or coercive or brainwashing. But I was like, yeah, you're right. He's kind of a jerk sometimes. And even saying that felt like I had this tiny spark that he couldn't crush. When he kept telling me that I was worthless and all these things, the one thing that I always held on to, I was like, no, you're lying. And I know that you're lying about this one thing, because even if I am totally and completely worthless, he'd call me stupid. And I know that I'm not stupid. I may not be a genius, but I know I'm smart. And I eventually started thinking during that weekend, well, if he lies about that and he's bullshitting me about that, calling me stupid, like, what else is he lying about? I talked to one of my friends over Facebook. I said I wasn't super happy. And unbeknownst to me, she'd asked for my address so she could send me a Christmas present, because it was in December. But she gave my address to my parents. My parents had apparently, since after I cut contact with them, been hiring private investigators in the States to try and find me. And the private investigators coordinated with Australian PIs to try and find me. And the Australian PIs eventually found my escort advertisement online. And so they were able to find me that way, but also because of the address she gave them. By the end of that weekend, I'd pretty much decided that I wanted to spend some more time away from him, and that I wanted to hang out with, like, this cool girl more and her boyfriend. And so he and all the girls roll up to pick me up because my punishment's over or whatever. And I'm like, no, honestly, I'm good. I'll come back later. Because there's only the one car, so I didn't even expect that they'd pick me up. They've let me fend for myself many times before. He harassed her and bothered her and banged on her door and called her so incessantly over the next several hours that I was like, he's never going to let up and he's never going to let her alone if I don't at least go out and talk to him. So I went out to talk to him, and they all kind of circled up around me, and they started screaming at me about how I was a worthless failure and I was such a disappointment and how awful an investment basically I'd been. So I let them go at that for a while, but eventually I was like, well, if I'm so worthless and such a disappointment, then I guess I should just go. So I turned around and I tried to walk away and go back into her apartment. And he had them grab me physically and prevent me from leaving. They frog marched me to the car. They put me in the car. They drove back to the house. They frog marched me into his bedroom. And he locked me in the bedroom with him all night while he continued to berate me and demand why I had been such a fuck-up and why I was such a failure. Eventually in the morning, he left to go exercise. And I had, like, 2 minutes before the next girl came in to babysit me. And I lunged for my phone, and I called my parents, and I was like, can you get me out if I want to get out? And they said, yes, we'll send someone for you later today if you are ready for them. When he came back from exercising, the cycle of abuse kind of swung around again, and he went to the making up and being very nice and apologetic. And of course, again, I repeat, I was brainwashed. So now I'm confused. Now maybe I don't want to leave. I apologize. I promise to do better. It's all kiss, kiss, hug, hug. And then the doorbell rings. And this private investigator is here with a note from my parents and is like, can you come outside and talk? I go outside and she walks me down to this car. She says, why don't you read the note in the car? And I'm like, no, I'm good. I can read it out here. And she goes, well, see, here's the thing. Everyone in there is in an illegal prostitution ring. And if you go back inside that house, you'll be arrested along with everybody and you'll be held criminally liable. So I recommend that you get in the car. So I got in the car and it drove off with me in it and took me down to the police station. So now I have been held against my will twice within 24 hours and once now by the police. They tried to get me to basically rat out everyone else. But of course, at that point, I wouldn't. They sent two plainclothes officers with me to purchase cheap-ass luggage for me and then to take me back to the house so that I could pack and then they could leave with me. Simon started screaming at them because he didn't know who they were. He didn't know that they were police. And, oh, he let them have it with both barrels. Everyone was like, oh my God, where were you? I was so scared. I was so worried. You went. You were gone. And so when the police asked if I wanted to go with him, I said no. So as soon as they left, I told him that they were police, that he just screamed at the police and that what they'd said about the whole illegal prostitution ring. And he flipped on a dime again and he said that I had ruined everything, that I had ruined his life. And how dare I, and how dare my parents? It was then that I was like, this isn't going to get any better. He's going to be so busy freaking out about that right now that he's not even going to care if I pack my stuff and I go. So I packed my shit and I went to the hotel room where we all escorted from. And I slept there for the night while I called the PI back and because she'd given me her card and I was like, can you get me on a flight out of Australia tomorrow? And she said, yeah. Yeah, we can. He didn't contact me until I was literally sitting in the lounge waiting for my flight to take off. So he didn't care enough to come after me until it was basically too late. I told him I'd come back, but I wanted to spend Christmas with my parents. That's what I said to him. The thing that busted it open wasn't even, you know, prostitution, because prostitution is legal in Australia. It was tax fraud, basically, because we weren't all reporting all of our income and we were all using the same hotel room when we should have had separate hotel rooms for each of us. It was some stupid tax loophole that got the police onto him. Not the fact that he was, you know, abusing women. Over the next 6 months, I was in and out of contact with him while I was in the States. My parents, they didn't take it well. I saw an email from my dad to my mom saying, I don't know if I can live with having a whore for a daughter. I don't know if I can ever talk to her again. They confiscated my passport and my birth certificate and a lot of stuff, and they put it in the lockbox that I didn't have access to so I couldn't leave the country again. And when I did not immediately heal from being brainwashed and being a survivor of this trauma, because I was still spouting the party line that I'd chosen this and I wanted to do it, I mean, they got really pissed off. And there was screaming that if he came to the door with a shotgun, they'd just let him have me. And there was hitting and there was a lot of fighting. I was no longer the daughter that they wanted to have, and that things were never going to be the same between us because of that. Things got so bad with my parents. At certain points, I was still kind of in contact with him, and I'd be like, yeah, I do want to come back, because anything's better than basically being held prisoner in your own house by people who scream at you all the time. And that kind of states how I felt about that. He did eventually actually come after me about 6 months later. I was at work one day. Like, I worked at a public zoo and I saw him get on my tram. So he hired his own private investigators to, I guess, track me down. And he showed up to try and take me back. I thought I was having a heart attack or a stroke or something. Like, I could not believe that he was actually there. He tried to pull a whole line on me of how he'd changed and I was going to be his princess and I wouldn't never have to escort again, blah, blah, blah. Like exactly what he'd said the first time. And it just sort of all fell apart and I went, oh God, just go away. Nothing you say is true. I was afraid of the emotional damage that he would do and the fact that he might try and convince me and I might be convinced to go back more than I was afraid that he would, like, punch me or, you know, he was never super physically abusive. It was emotional and psychological warfare at all times instead. So I was more afraid of the number he'd do on my psyche.
He's like, if you don't come with me now, you'll never see me again. He says, you'll never see me again. And you'll think about me for the rest of your life and you will never find anyone else like me. And you will only ever find poor replacements for me. And you will regret basically this forever. And I thought, you know, that's probably partially true. I definitely will think about you for the rest of my life, but probably not in the way that you're thinking. I was there with him for a few days. I actually had to pay his luggage fees for him to leave because his fortunes had turned around so much that he was like, I don't have the money to leave. And I'm like, oh, well, I'll help. Here's $60. If you ask me now, didn't I have a bunch of opportunities to leave? Like, he wasn't physically holding me. Why did I stay? Why didn't I go? I wish I knew. I feel like I was inundated with his particular brand of reality from the get-go. And it never stopped. It was so constant that I got sucked into it, I suppose. And before I knew it, I was operating by his laws of reality instead of what was actually real. And I had nothing to compare it to. Because Christian virgin, like, I had nothing to compare this to. I thought, maybe I'm just being naive because I was raised pretty sheltered and pretty naive. And they all act like this is normal. So maybe this is normal. And I'm just the one who's shocked because I don't know any better. The one, I guess, therapist that I had the lady who kind of brought Elizabeth Smart back after her kidnapping. And she made me realize at least that he had a lot of sociopathic traits. If he wasn't a sociopath, then he definitely was on the spectrum. I mean, now I'm willing to acknowledge, of course, he was a full-blown sociopath. My God, what else could he be? But then she was like, go to this website called Love Fraud and read the stories of a lot of the women there and see if you, like, see if anything resonates. So I did. And yeah, there are a lot of abusers out there who have very similar patterns. And that's when it kind of started to sink in for me that I had been manipulated and I'd been had and I'd been the victim of a sociopath. I definitely have PTSD, probably always will, from that. On the other hand, if I hadn't gone through all of that, I would not be with my fiancé now. One of the things that he said when he was there with me that week in America, he was saying how his version of BDSM and his version of kink was really the only valid one and that I should never try to go to a public dungeon. I should never meet the kink community. I would hate it. It would not be for me. So when basically everything that he'd said turned out to be a manipulation or a lie, I thought, well, that's probably a lie too. And I decided I was going to go visit my local kink community and see what it was really like. Because, of course, I still had these interests. It's not like they necessarily go away just because someone's been abusing them. And the first night that I ever stepped foot into my local dungeon, my fiancé was there. He actually lived in a totally different state, but his mother lived up where I was, and he was visiting her, and he swung by the local dungeon to check it out. And it just happened to be the one night of not just the entire year, but pretty much of ever, that we would have been in the same place at the same time and been able to even meet.
I had these disassociative moments. First of all, when I was driving, sometimes I'd drive on the wrong side of the road because I'd think I was still in Australia. And second of all, whenever I tried to be intimate with someone, as a way of protecting myself while my body was having these things done to it, my mind would be off going, oh God, I need to do laundry, or oh crap, did I remember to turn the dishwasher on, or oh, I need to wash the sheets after this. Oh, I need to touch up my makeup. Like, I would be thinking about something completely different. I would be on autopilot. For years afterward, it was actually really hard for me to be intimate with someone and also be present in the moment, because I was so used to just letting my body be a thing that other people did things with. And my brain was, like, separate instead of, like, the whole of me being participatory. I still struggle with that on occasion. Because that was my entry into sexuality, I had some pretty self-destructive ideas about what my body was good for or what I would let people do to it or with it for a while. Actually, kink really helped with that because they have a very consent-positive culture. And no one is allowed to touch you without your consent. Like, consent is, above all, consent is God. And it's always, if you're not super positive on everything that we're doing, then we don't do it. And that helped a lot. That helped me come to terms with, I was allowed to have limits and I was allowed to not like things. And people weren't necessarily going to hate me for that. You know, I was allowed to say no and that would be okay. I may have been ignorant and stupid and naive and so I didn't know about the evil of the world, but even so, I didn't deserve that. I didn't deserve to walk into that kind of hell. Sometimes I still struggle with that. I think I was so stupid, and if I had just not been so stupid, I could have gotten out sooner. I should have gotten out sooner. I'm smart, so why didn't I see it? Like, why did I let this happen? And I struggle with, is it even rape? Because technically I agreed to it. Was I coerced and manipulated? And was I feeling like I had no other alternatives, no other options? Yeah. But did I let them do it? Like, I let them do it. So is that even a crime? Is that even a sin? Is that even something that shouldn't have happened? I don't know, and I may never know, how much agency did I really have versus how much I felt like I had. What could I have really done? What should I have really done? Am I at fault? Am I to blame? Is this not a horror story? Am I not a victim? Should I not be able to say that because I let it happen? Should I not say I'm a human trafficking victim? Should I not say I'm a victim at all? Should I just say that I was stupid and young? And I learned my lesson. What should I say? What can I say? What am I allowed to say without harming the experience of other victims and survivors who have had it probably so much worse than me? I honestly don't know the answer to that. I know that he was a bad man. I know that he was a sociopath. I know that he did bad things like that. I can pretty clearly iron out, but as far as my own culpability is concerned, I don't know if in the human heart there will ever be black and white answers to something like that. I feel like there are people out there who are going to listen to this and say, yeah, she was dumb and she got what she deserved. Because if I think that sometimes, then of course other people are going to. I think that maybe they're like I was back then before this happened. They don't know how much evil is actually in the world. They don't realize what forms it can take. And they believe in a just world fallacy, that if I do the right things, then bad things won't happen to me. Bad things only happen to people that deserve it. I used to believe that once too. I can't hate anyone for thinking that way. I envy them, I guess, for thinking that way, because it means that they have not experienced the depths of human depravity, so they can afford to still think that way. I feel like no one got out of this alive, including me. I feel like the girl I was is dead, and the person who is saying this now is someone else. I had faith in God. I had faith in basic human goodness.
I was, if not outgoing, like, I was involved in theater, you know, I was involved in stage stuff. I had hobbies and interests and things like that that I just couldn't touch for years afterward. I don't do a lot of the things that I used to do anymore. I don't want to say that he ruined them all for me, but I just can't relate to them in the same way. No matter how bad it gets, it's already been worse. So this is never going to be as bad as it gets. This is never going to be the worst moment in my life because I feel like I've already had that. So I can afford to take risks and do things sometimes because, not because I'm living on borrowed time, but because I really genuinely thought at the time that either he would kill me because he kept talking about how we would all need to die for him or he would kill us. Or I thought I would like jump off a bridge, that I would kill myself because I couldn't stand living this way. So every birthday I have, I feel like it's a win. It's a victory. Like, I'm getting older, but sweet, I never thought I'd make it to 30. Every year is like a fuck you and a awesome, I'm still here. What else can I do? The girl I was before would never have been involved in kink. Even if she'd wanted to be, she would never have rolled up to a public dungeon and been like, hey. But now a lot of the life and the relationship that I do have, actually one of the things that bonded us when I met him, his dad was a sociopath. He grew up with a sociopath for a father. And because of that, he was able to relate to me on a level of like, yeah, I know all the tricks that they play. I lived that. Some are more successful than others, but yeah, this sounds like my experience. And it's a really shitty club to be a member of, to be clear. I don't want to be a member of this club. I wish I wasn't. And I wish that he wasn't. But we can identify each other. And he helped me and has helped and continues to help me heal because he had to live with his a lot longer than I had to live with mine. Knowing that he also got out and his father is dead now and there is life beyond. And he is so much more healed than maybe I will ever be. I don't know. But I see in him like the life that I am striving for and the life that we can keep having together. And also he is also into kink. So we do have that aspect of our relationship. We have really open, clear, and honest communication. And we've never had anything that we can't discuss. I really value that. There are probably a billion parallel universes out there, and we got so lucky that we live in the one where we were both there that night, and we were able to meet. And I just want to make it clear, I guess, to other members of the club that if the worst thing in the world has already ever happened to you, the world's already ended, so just go play in the ashes. Like, you can do whatever you want. All I can do, and all that I want to do, is make my corner of the world with the people who are in it with me a good place and a better place and a safe place and a supportive place. So I really care about animals. I cannot possibly stand animal abusers, and I think that they will go to the special place in hell, so if there's a hell. So animals for me, you know, I donate to animal charities. I volunteer my time. I have a bunch of animals, like... Pick one thing that you care about and just make that be your thing. There may be no justice in the world and the world may be full of evil, but if all of us just try and make our tiny corners okay, maybe we have a patchwork of okay parts of the world, and maybe that's how it gets better. Maybe it's not about the giant sweeping changes that don't always happen. Maybe it's about what can you personally do for the people that you personally come in contact with.
This Is Actually Happening is brought to you by me, Whit Misseldine. If you love what we do, you can join the community on our official Instagram page, at Actually Happening. You can also rate and review the show on iTunes, which helps tremendously to boost visibility to a larger community of listeners. And thank you for listening. Until next time, stay tuned.
Hey Prime members, you can listen to This Is Actually Happening ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.